You are listening to the podcast version of Write the Book, which airs every Monday from 2 to 3 on the Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and Write the Book is a show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. This is the show from Monday, January 17th, 2011. It was an interview from the archives with acclaimed author Rosellyn Brown. Writer of poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction, Rosellyn Brown is the author of the New York Times bestseller Before and After, and four other novels, The Autobiography of My Mother, Tender Mercies, Civil Wars, and Half a Heart. She has written a collection of stories, Street Games, and three collections of poetry, Some Deaths in the Delta, Cora Fry, and Cora Fry's Pillow Book. Her work has appeared in the O. Henry Prize Stories, Best American Short Stories, and Best Short Stories of the Century. She's won Pushcart Prizes, NEA Grants, an award in literature from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, an Ingram Merrill Foundation grant, the Janet Kafka Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Bunting Institute Fellowship, and a Howard Foundation Fellowship. She lives in Chicago, where she's on faculty at the MFA in Writing program at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. After many summers leading the Spoleto Writers Workshop in Umbria, Italy, she's now a member of the faculty of the Art Workshop International in Assisi. Her website says she has one husband, two daughters, two cats, too many books. She lives in President Obama's neighborhood overlooking Lake Michigan. In 2009, Rosellyn Brown was a visiting writer at the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Writing program. I spoke to her during that program's winter residency. As a child, Rosellyn Brown's family moved a lot, and I began by asking if she thought this had affected her choice to become a writer.
I think it had a very, very clear... I can actually trace the clarity of the connection, which I think is unusual for a lot of people. But what happened was, when I was about 9, we moved from New York. I lived in Mount Vernon, New York, in Westchester. We moved to Los Angeles. We lived there for a year. And the first summer that we were there, we came in the middle of the summer, I made friends in the neighborhood the way you will. And when September came, there happened to be a zone line that went right through the neighborhood. I'll bet you didn't expect as precise an answer as this, but I have it. I've actually written about it. The zone line separated me from the friends that I had so laboriously made during the summer. And they went to one school, and I went to another one by myself, basically. I knew nobody. And I started coming to school with a little secretarial notebook, the kind with the line down the middle. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if they make them anymore.
Sure.
Because who's taking
stenography notebook,
anymore?
Right.
Stenographer's notebook clutched to my non-existent bosom. I was 9, and I would come out to our, to the playground at recess or whatever, and sit under a tree and write, because it was like bringing a friend with me, and I didn't have to confront. Eventually, I made friends, sort of, but we didn't stay very long, as I said. But basically, I didn't have to confront being alone that way, and I kind of discovered that you could always have a friend if you could write, and I began writing poetry and not paying very much attention to the genre. I wrote a mystery story, which I believe I got more or less out of classic comics. It was a Sherlock Holmes type thing called Murder Stalks at Midnight. And that was such an unoriginal title that my oldest brother, who was a jazz drummer, or becoming a jazz drummer at that time, he already was actually, told me that there was either, I can't remember whose it was, Coleman Hawkins or someone, actually had a record called Celery Stalks at Midnight. That's how unoriginal my title was. But I was off and running, and then, it turned out that I think this happens with a lot of people who have one kind of artistic talent. I was a very good artist, and I was a very pretty good musician. I played the piano, and really kind of pursued all of them at one time, but for who knows what reason the writing won out. I mean, at that time we lived back in New York, and I really wanted to go to the High School of Music and Art for music and art, but we lived too far away. But if I had gone to that, I probably could have gone in music or art, and maybe one of those would have been the direction that I went in. But instead,
you know, I just went to an ordinary school and I continued to write and wrote all through my teenage years. And, you know, it's just, I think, fairly unusual, though, to have that sense that you know when the actual writing began as a kind of comfort, which is really what it was.
Now, was reading a comfort before that?
I think so, yes. I loved to read as a kid, and I remember, I give my parents a lot of credit for this. My mother, who didn't even go to high school, so it wasn't as if she was educated, highly educated, but she read me the Christopher Robin poems, you know, A.A. Milne, and I remember them buying me books. I have very specific memories of presents that I got from them, as, you know, a book by Phyllis McGinley called The Plain Princess. I remember they went to a school, you know, book fair and brought it back for me. And I have a memory of listening to a radio program called Treasure Island that was for kids. And it was on in the late afternoon. And I remember they would have these little contests, and you could write them a little essay or a letter or something, and I remember winning a book about the dog lost its tail or something, but I must have written them something, and I was somewhere between 5 and 9, because I can, you know, the one advantage of living in a lot of places as a kid is that you can, you remember when things happen, because you remember what the backdrop was, because it was this city or that city. And so I can picture, you know, where I was when I was listening to this radio program. So it was obviously already writing, you know, and reading, and loving to read. I really have visceral memories of the shape and look of certain books. Yeah. So there was a fairy tale book, and I remember reading about the 12 dancing princesses, and I can picture the illustration that went with it. And I don't have a particularly good memory for a lot of things. I wish I had a better memory now for the contents of many books, which I don't. But I do have such, and I'm sure many people do, who love books, have very, very precise memories of the books that they loved when they were children.
Right. And then so, you can't remember anything from the last 10 years.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
What inspired you to write your first novel?
Well, that's sort of interesting, because it will sound very external. It was a combination of internal and external exigencies, I guess you could call them. I had written poetry first. I wrote only poetry in college. And my first book was a book of poems, although it ended with a kind of prose poem. I thought I was inventing the form. I was apparently not well educated, didn't know that Baudelaire had gotten there first, and a lot of other people. So it ended with something that was pretty prosy, but in a kind of highly poetic style. And then I began writing stories, which I loved. I'll never forget the feeling of standing on almost as if I was on a mountaintop looking out at this valley of possibilities in prose, because I had never, you know, you write poetry, you're always swimming hard against the tide, and when you begin to write prose, it's almost as if you're floating. And that's not to say that it's easy, but it is very much less constrained and constraining. So I was writing stories, and for one thing, when I tried to publish my book of stories, I had heard from an editor, this happens a lot, people get letters from editors who are sort of scouting, and I used to get a number of letters that would say, I read your, and then they would always use two adjectives, your taut and poignant story in the such and such magazine review, or your humorous and, you know, whatever story in whatever magazine. If you ever have a longer fiction, please submit it to us. Of course, by longer fiction, they mean we don't really care about short stories. We'd rather have a novel. So that was sort of in the back of my mind. And an editor actually wrote to me and I ended up actually bringing her my book of stories. She loved it. She wanted to publish it. And at the last minute was overruled. She was with Atlantic Little Brown, which were together at that time. Before now, everybody's consolidating, but in those days, actually, they were together. And she, who worked for the Atlantic Press, loved it, but Little Brown said, we don't need this book. And she ended up not publishing it, but it gave me heart somehow to go on and try to get it published. And then what I did, and this is crazy, I'm actually answering a different question, but I'll get to that. This is how the book of stories got published. I had won a couple of O. Henry prizes, and maybe one of them was... No, it was just O. Henry. I think I'd won two of them. of the stories that had been in magazines that were chosen as among the best stories of the year. And I thought that the editor of the O. Henry Prizes, William Abrahams, worked for Doubleday, which published the book, the annual anthology. And so I very naively sent the book of stories off to William Abrahams, and I got a most amused letter back from an editor at Doubleday saying, oh dear, no, you know, he doesn't work for us, he just edits the books from California or wherever he lived, but I love the book and I'd like to publish it.
Oh, wow.
So what I got, which is very common for books of stories, I got a two-book contract, which gave them the stories and promised a novel. So that was one of the exterior stimuli. The other one was that I had published a story. One of the stories that I published was in the Transatlantic Review, called Going to See the Rainbows. And it, two different people who read the story said to me, my goodness, I want it. It was about a woman who walks with a child, holding the child's hand, above a kind of cataract, a waterfall, and drops the child's hand at one point, and the child goes over the edge. This is terrible. My agent, who had two daughters, as do I, refused to read this. I mean, she just was too horrible for her. The child goes over the edge into the and perishes in the waterfalls. And two different people read this and said, I would like to know how they got to the edge of that precipice. Who? It was a kind of a mysterious, slightly mysterious story with undercurrents of psychological need. The person with the child was not her mother or her anyone related to her. She was the friend of the child's mother. And there was a sense that she didn't have a child and maybe wanted one. I don't even remember anymore. You know, in a story, you don't have to fill in all those blanks. You can get away with a certain kind of vagueness, you know. It was almost like the mist from the waterfall were enough to take care of whatever you needed of psychological implication. So these two different people, unrelated to each other, you know, said to me, I'm very curious about who were these people and why were they there and so on. And so at the time that I needed a novel, because they had published, they were very nice, Doubleday actually did not, sometimes they have you write the novel first and then they'll do the stories afterwards, this sort of booby prize. But in this case, they actually published the book of stories first and then they waited patiently for the novel. And the funny thing about this, in retrospect, this is so amusing. It took me a year and a half to write the novel, which I thought, after only having written poems and stories, it was just ridiculous that it would have taken that long. I didn't know writers. There was much less about writers that was out there at the time. You didn't know all the ins and outs of the writer's life somehow.
Talking all these procedurals.
Yeah, there were, exactly. I mean, I'm talking, you know, the book came out in 1976, so I'm talking about between 74 and 76, and it just was not as much of that around, and so I didn't realize that a year and a half, boy, I'd be very happy now to write a novel in a year and a half. But I wrote this book. I felt like I had a kind of paper bag over my head. I had no idea how to write a novel. I hadn't even read a lot of novels because I had been a poet. And then I read a lot of short stories, and I kind of was oddly innocent when I wrote this. And I was so uncertain of it, honestly. I really do mean this, Shayla. I was trying to type it from it, because I write by hand. I did then, and I still do. And I was putting it on my typewriter. I didn't have, obviously, a computer at that time. And I decided it was so awful and that no one would want to read it, and now that it was going to be typed, it would be readable by someone other than me, that I was approaching the wood stove, we lived in New Hampshire at the time, to throw it in, and I am not exaggerating. And my husband happened to be working at home that day, and he said, stop. Just type it. Don't read it. Don't think about it. Just type the, you know, just make a TypeScript out of it and stop judging it. And I did. And I finished it. And by then he was able to read it. And he said, you're crazy. And I sent it off to my agent. And she sent it to my editor. I don't remember her response. If I had any response from her at all, I just know that I got a telegram, again, back in the dark ages when you got telegrams, from my editor who was the editor who had bought the stories, saying, congratulations, this is a wonderful novel. And, you know, again, it was not the time of MFAs, of people reading your stuff, of open mics, of anything like that. And so I'd been completely alone with it. No one had read it except my husband. And so this telegram, I mean, I should have framed it the way businesses frame their first dollar bill, you know, was just absolutely out of the blue, telling me, well, yes, you can write a novel. And then the book was beautifully reviewed, which was, again, a complete surprise to me because I didn't even know if I was holding anything together. It was, it's a very odd and slightly depressing book. Well, you can imagine it ends with that scene in the waterfalls. Different person now. The woman who had dropped the child's hand in the story had now morphed into the grandmother of the child, and it's a kind of angst-ridden, tormented argument between a mother and daughter, and then the daughter has an illegitimate, in the word in those days, child, and that's the one who perishes. And it really, that is kind of about the agon between the mother and daughter, and this little child has to die for it. Terrible, terrible. but it was, you know, it got reviewed.
Which novel is that?
This is the autobiography of my mother.
Okay.
And it was just, again, astounding to me. I mean, I'd read these reviews and I'd say, my God, they found it coherent. And over the years, a lot of people have told me, especially women who've read it, I'm sure not many men have read it, but a lot of women have read it and told me that they had dreams about their mothers afterwards. It sort of seemed to have brought up in them, brought to the surface a lot of their conflicts with their mothers. I have to say that my own mother was relieved to discover that it had zero to do with her. Totally, totally unrelated. I've laughed sometimes in the past that I used to tell people that the only thing it had in common with my mother was that the mother in this book and my mother used to put toilet paper down on the seats of public toilets and sit on them. But other than that, because the woman in the book was a 72-year-old emigre lawyer, an attorney from Alsace-Lorraine, and her syntax is very Germanic because German was her original language, and her daughter is a kind of withered hippie flower child, and so her language, of course, is tremendously different. And I was playing with voices, as I did in my book of stories, and I love doing voices. I love, you know, doing other. I'm not interested in myself. I'm very, very little interest in writing about myself, and I think it may be one of the reasons that I'm a fiction writer. Is that it gives me the chance to be curious about other people,
right?
And either to create them or to drag them into my writing.
Now, that reminds me of another question I had for you as far as speaking in other voices. Some of your work has dealt with race and civil rights. I have a friend who went through this program, actually, and her thesis here was about the white writer's ability to depict the black experience. Yeah. And in her own work, she occasionally found this to be a challenge on certain levels, partly because she felt she wasn't really entirely entitled to write about
Right. Well, it's a challenge both externally and internally. I mean, the first one of the challenges you worry about, of course, is how will it be received? Will you be called a carpetbagger? You know, will you be told to get back into your own life and leave this alone? But the other challenge, of course, is the internal one where you are asking yourself, am I getting this right? And do I have a right? And am I appropriating something that isn't mine? My response to that, and of course some of this has to do with how well do you do it, but that's not sufficient to answer the questions, is do you have a right to do it? Let's just assume for the sake of argument that you can do it well if you've spent a lot of time with African-American friends or students or whatever, and for whatever reason you're able to do this well, which I hope I am. I have a very complicated response to it because it seems to me that on the one hand, people are saying, understand us. Why do you not get us? Why do white folks not have black friends? You know, are you not comfortable with us? You know, can you walk a mile in my shoes to understand what my life is like? Then it seems to me in some ways difficult to turn around and say, but I don't want you to try to write in my voice because you couldn't possibly know about that. And I find myself saying, well, what I've done is I hope try to extend my sense of empathy as far as it possibly can go to try to enter your life. I wrote a book with a quadriplegic character in it, and I had to go very far.
That was
Tender Mercies. In fact, in some ways farther to enter the mind of a quadriplegic, because I know much more about many things than I did about quadriplegics until I began to give it a great deal of thought and some research and so on. And so my feeling is, you know, that it's it's odd to say I want you to really understand me deeply, but on the other hand, keep your hands off my life mm-hmm. and don't try to represent me. And so I feel as if every writer writes, has to extend herself or himself into the lives of other people. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, yeah, you could get it wrong. You could get any number of things wrong. You could get doing an Italian character wrong or a Jewish character or a, you know, whatever. I could get wrong what it's like to be as tall as you are, you know, because I'm short and you're tall and I don't know what the world looks like up there, you know. So, you know, they're matters of degree, but of course the political enters into that one mm-hmm. in a way that it probably doesn't, you know, between short people and tall people. Is it Randy Newman who has that song, Short People?
He politicized it.
Politicized it, right. So I feel, of course, it's a delicate matter. You worry about it. I worried a lot when my novel Half a Heart came out because it is, although I had already in my books, Street Games, the book of stories that came out a long time earlier than that, 1974, I have black characters, I have Puerto Rican characters, and old and young, and rich and poor, and all of those people. So I was already doing voices. But when Half a Heart, which of course would get more publicity, came out, I really worried about what kind of response I would get. And I was very gratified. I don't think very many African-American readers read it. They weren't particularly interested in it. I didn't care particularly what this white girl thought about what it would be like to be a biracial teenager who's one of the characters. But and also, by the way, the book is sort of in some ways capacious enough, if that's the word for it, to allow, I mean, there's one white character, the mother of this biracial girl, and there's the girl herself, and the mother can make a lot of mistakes that can be sort of a surrogate for some of the mistakes that I might be making in understanding the girl, you know. But the fact is that every African American reader that I know of, that who has either told me from the audience of a bookstore or a university or written to me, have said they love the book and they thought I got things right.
So you take a chance and then...
And you hope that you can do it, you know. And somebody actually, a friend of my brother, my oldest brother, was a jazz drummer, so he had a lot of black friends many years ago. And one of them came to a reading of mine, and he had read the book also, and he said, oh, girl, I don't know how you knew some of these things. And I was just delighted because he said, you know, there were 13 things you got right that I didn't think you know or something like that. And I was delighted. But, you know, it's fraught. There's no denying it. And people get very, very... get their noses out of joint easily if you, you know, give away the fact that you don't really understand. And it's dangerous. But I kind of find the danger, it's exhilarating, mm-hmm. too, because I did want to extend myself far enough into the life of this girl to try to figure out what it would feel like, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's complex. And the way in which things are resolved, they're actually unresolved at the end of the book, allows, I think, for a great deal of ambiguity, a great deal of irresolution, this about a reunion between this mother who's given up her child at birth and who meets her when she's 18, and so both of them are deep into their very different lives. And I use as an epigraph for the book one of my favorite lines from Chekhov, from the end of The Lady with the Lapdog, this mm-hmm. the beautiful story, I think it's one of the greatest stories ever, in which this lover acknowledges that the difficult part is only beginning between himself and his lover. But in my book, of course, it's between the mother and daughter who have a rapprochement finally. They've begun to be able to talk to each other, but the difficult part is it's just ongoing, mm-hmm. you know. So that's how I deal with that question.
I wonder if this would be a good time for you to read from your work.
Oh, I would love to. Absolutely. Just very briefly so that listeners can understand this. Before and After is a book, a novel in which a teenage boy kills his girlfriend, does not intend to, but in a sort of crime of passion he does. It's not a murder mystery. The book is a kind of... attempt to grapple with the question of whether his parents, after he's run away, should be trying to catch him and bring him to justice or help him escape. And, you know, what is, it's about many, many things, but, you know, what is the proper moral way to approach that question? But along the way, the book is really, to me, about parents trying to account for who their children become and how responsible they are. It's really interesting. When the movie was made of this book, the reason that movie was made was that Meryl Streep had a 15-year-old son, and she read the book, not even just a treatment, but she actually read the book, and she was compelled by the book and the questions in it because she had a child of that age. So it's really, the book is truly about, you know, parents and children, and the murder was there because something had to happen, you know. I had to get something going so I could ask these questions, which were much larger questions. And so at this point, their son, Jacob, is missing. He has run off after this murder and is being, you know, kind of tracked, or everybody's trying to find him. And she is thinking very bitterly about him. He's 17. Okay. And these few pages are really about this question. So this is Carolyn.
And I'm just going to say, this is Rosalind Brown, reading from Before and After, published by
Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and then it's now available in a Dell paperback.
Okay.
Was he walking around Harvard Square looking like another hip kid? It was like a slightly thinned-out Calcutta there, a claustrophobic bazaar of the affluent, the crowds pressing anonymously around you, people handing you flyers for jazz clubs, nail shops, self-defense classes, half the kids still and forever scruffy in khakis and hair that called attention to itself by extreme length or shortness or color or wild and monstrous shape. Maybe he was there passing as a Harvard kid, or a hanger-on, or walking in the combat zone, peering into the sex clubs at the photos of the naked girls with their eyes blacked out. Everyone in that part of town looked hunted. Partly it was being a mother. Partly it was being a doctor who lived for, put all her sentiment into the welfare of children. Every moment of her life, it seemed, was devoted to making children comfortable, lessening their pain, or keeping it from happening in the first place. She sat staring across the plants on the wide windowsill of the kitchen, fixed on the bird feeder that sagged from the little sycamore. They didn't bother, in fact, they didn't dare to fill it anymore, because Snappy the cat went up and dragged out the birds, and then they discovered the squirrels that patrolled and menaced, digging the fallen seeds out of the snow, walking upside down on the electric wire, and leaping onto the branch, any old way to get to the feeder. They weren't buying seed to keep the squirrels fed. Then the cat brought in a squirrel carcass, opened, pink inside like a skinned chicken breast, red in tooth and claw everywhere you looked. She refused to think of him little, being soothed, powdered, padded. She saw him pulling on his current ski jacket. He had a sharp black one with red and yellow stripes in which she could see he felt expansive, mysterious, a little sinister. Last summer, diving off a rock at Skaggs Pond, his stomach concave, his elbows sharp. Boy at the ragged edge of manhood. She saw him trying to be fierce, to see if he could actually be cruel, and to stop herself from remembering him helpless and tiny. Motherhood didn't keep. Why didn't more people admit it, that each phase was succeeded so totally by the next, if you were concentrating as hard as you had to, that sometimes she had trouble believing she'd been there? Their infancy was a rumor, distant, prodded by photographs and a few tapes. Judith had a lisp. Jacob giggled incessantly, gulping breath. He hiccuped a lot. She used to worry about him because he took in so much air. She was astonished to hear them talking to each other on the tapes, singing their songs. These were the voices of someone else's children. And then there were the videos, literal and abrupt. But they missed all the early years. And Jacob was better documented than Judith, the first, and they were somehow less busy then, but neither was sufficiently whole in her own unaided memory. It was a cheat. And she had begun to realize recently, especially as she watched her parents arrive in their 70s and 80s, that her whole life would fade the same way. A distant image, no more immediate than a good, at best a good, movie. If she concentrated as hard as she could, she might see something like snapshots. But memory, blood memory, was overrated. In books, it was too sharp, too clear and continuous. In fact, everything was shadow, The past was only an abstract idea broken into by little shards of clear image, no longer than TV sound bites. Cheat, cheat, cheat. She had been appalled when she was a teenager to watch how her cat failed to recognize her own kittens when they passed a certain age or feel for them. The cat was a beautiful black longhair named Scumbles, and her mothering was so natural, her devotion so profound and complex, that Carolyn had been rapt with admiration. Watching the new mother moving her kittens, jerking them up by their damp scruffs and delivering them squealing to fresh hiding places for reasons no human could fathom, she was happy to think of herself as an animal, too. It was ennobling to be even distantly related to this loving, warming, protective little creature who, uninstructed, huddled around her five babies who were as small as thumbs and licked them till they glistened. But it was only a few months before she discovered Scumbles hissing viciously at her own half-grown babies like a stranger. She had grown territorial and selfish about her food. Unsentimental, Carolyn had protested. How could she not feel the connection forever? How could she not know their smell and love it? Well, maybe if she saw him, she could recover that connection. Maybe if she put her arms around him and remembered. But the boy she'd held against her had scooped up off the ground and balanced on her hip, had carried in his sleep, was gone anyway. That wasn't the one she'd have if he stood in the doorway right now. The cat she'd have was a grown one who scented his fur with aftershave, deodorant, and mousse to disguise the smell his mother might claim as hers. A cat who did what he wanted to. A Tom. She put her head on her folded arms and wept.
Thank you very much. I love how you have her avoiding thinking about the little boy that he was, because her whole character is about trying to figure out how she's responsible.
Exactly.
Or what she can do to
both.
To
how
be
is she responsible
person.
And what is responsible now? And then, of course, she's forced to think about the girl that he's killed, whose parents love her as they love their son, and somehow deserve, they, nothing will bring her back, but deserve some kind of at least abstract justice.
Now, I know that the murder, in a sense, is almost incidental to the story you were trying to tell.
Right, but it does, it gives the plot backbone.
Came first, though, for you?
Well, that's an interesting question. This book actually was, I like to say, stimulated by, not inspired by, a real thing that happened. And it's very, it raises such interesting questions for me about the way the imagination works. I'll tell you the story. 4 years after it had happened and had been a very big news item in Houston, where I was living at the time, I woke up one morning wanting to write a play. Actually, this began as a play, not as a novel. I remembered a case, a boy of about the same age, 17, kind of a slow-witted boy, had an encounter with a young woman who was a male person, delivering mail, and she was filling in, a very pretty young woman was filling in for someone that day, so she had never walked this route before. She came to his house. He was home alone. He lured her into the house for obviously nefarious purposes, and when she ran away or tried to run away, he shot her and killed her in the house, leaving evidence, bullet holes and blood and so on everywhere. And then he was obviously slow. He threw his bloody clothes into the washing machine and he took off. And he came back the next day while the detectives were out. They had dogs. They were tracing the route of this woman, young woman who had disappeared, and discovered, of course, that he had killed her. And what was interesting about this, unfortunately, there are lots of murders out there and they're not, you know, particularly interesting. But what had happened was that his parents, rather differently from my book, because they were unanimous about this, refused to testify. And there is a law that says that although husbands and wives cannot be forced to testify against each other, which goes back to the days when wives were chattel and therefore could not be asked to testify against their husbands because they were owned by their husbands. But parents have no such right. If you are called upon to give testimony about evidence found in your house or whatever that you know about your child being guilty of, you have got to give that evidence. And so there came a very bizarre moment when this boy was home on bail and his parents were in jail for contempt, which is pretty astonishing, turn of events. And ultimately he was adjudged guilty and he's in jail for life. What I somehow remember, I remembered something about this weird dissonance between the parents' reaction and what the state was demanding of them. And so I went looking for, old microfilm in which this story was before Google, which the story was told. And I was fascinated by what could you do with just the moral question. And my books often start with some kind of situation rather than with characters. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the situation was, oh my God, what would you do if your child were guilty of murder? I mean, how would you deal with it? Would you be like these parents who, again, were unanimous in their refusal to put, as they put it, to put the shackles on his wrists? Or would you, have some other way to deal with it? And in the book, there were many more dramatic possibilities by having the parents separate in their question and on the answer of how would they deal with it. Interestingly, I tried very hard not to talk about the original case because I changed everything. And then I remember having an interview with someone for People magazine who actually, because she was in Houston, I guess she was a stringer in Houston, and I guess she wanted to push the point, actually named the people in the original case and made it seem as if it was about that. And there was not a single thing in common with the original case except that young male kills young female. That's it. I moved them to New Hampshire. I felt as if having it happen in a small town would highlight everything. Mm-hmm. You cast a shadow that's much clearer in a small town where everyone knows everyone else. And then I changed the parents' situations completely, and everything about it, including the outcome, is totally different in the book. So it became mine. But that was, really in many ways, of all my books, probably the one with the most... that sort of nub of reality from which it started, but then I used that as a lever and I just changed everything.
I enjoyed an essay that you wrote called The Jewish Writer as Endangered Species.
Yeah, but that's out of date now. Things have changed a lot since the famous Jewish writers of the 50s, the Malamud Roth, that kind of writing. There really was not a lot happening, but I have to tell you that I was wrong.
It's changing.
There are, there's Allegra Goodman and there's Nathan Englander and there are all kinds of writers who have in fact found a lot of ways to bring Jewish experience forward in many, many, many ways. And even Hollywood is beginning now to acknowledge more Jewish life in film, not a lot, but a little bit. So I'm not quite sure how and why this has happened, but I think it really, I was wrong,
Now, there's a statement you make in there, though, aside from Judaism, and I found it very interesting, and I think you'll still probably feel a little bit this way. And the statement is that one, I'm paraphrasing part of this, one should not expect fiction to be direct moral instruction, a sort of user's guide to ethics and self-improvement.
Yes.
So actually, I was thinking we could talk about that a little bit, because I think that's very interesting still.
Yes, I'd love to talk about that. I actually once gave a talk called Dear Ms. Brown, How Should I Live My Life? And I ended up also writing that into an article that I wrote. The New York Times had a column on writing, writers on writing, and it's in a book of theirs. They have these volumes made from those columns, and I kind of recycled it for that. And basically what that referred to was that I go back to the autobiography of my mother. The novel we talked about at the mm-hmm. beginning is about this 72-year-old emigre civil liberties lawyer who is much more devoted to abstract questions of good and evil than she is somehow to dealing with her own daughter, whom she just can't manage very well. And her daughter accuses her of caring more about her, about the Constitution and other such things than she cared about her. And whether right or wrong, that is sort of a burden of the book. And so the mother is not necessarily an attractive character, or like many of my characters, she's good and not so good at the same time. She's real, yes, exactly. She's very flawed, no question about it. And so right after the book came out, I happened to have had dinner with a friend of mine in Cambridge. And he brought with him, he had gone to Harvard Law School, and he brought with him a law school friend, graduate, to dinner. And when it emerged that I had written this book, it turned out that this young woman had read it. Amazing. And I could see her face fall when we talked about the fact that I'd written it. And I did something really nasty, which is I sort of caught her, I disarmed her by saying, oh, I see, read the book. Oh, but I see you didn't like it. And of course, you don't like to be caught in that, but she was. And she sort of admitted it, and she said, well, yes, I'll tell you, you know, I'm a woman and a recent law school graduate, and it didn't tell me how to live my life. And I said, you're damn right it didn't tell you how to live your life. It was a novel. You know, I wasn't writing a letter of reference for this woman. That's not what you do when you write fiction. And I would have thought that was understood, but obviously it wasn't. And a lot of my characters have been called not particularly attractive. I mean, they're flawed because I'm trying to make them real. I actually had a phone call from a friend who finished reading my Half a Heart, who said, and she was a psychologist, which makes this even funnier, she said, I got so angry at both of them. I was so furious because they did so many things wrong. And then I stopped and said to myself, well, what would you have done in that situation? Might you not have screwed up, you know, similarly? And of course, you know, and she said, of course, I had to respect the book a lot for that, but didn't mean I loved the characters. And my rejoinder to this, and the thing that I wrote about in the essay that was in the Times and in the talk that I gave, was, you know, that when you think about the great characters in literature, and I don't claim to have produced any of them, but if you do think back to the people that you most want to hear on stage or read about or whatever, you've got King Lear, you've got the man in Notes from Underground, you've got just any number of hugely flawed characters.
Right. Everybody wants Atticus Finch.
Geez, yeah, exactly. I mean, Crime and Punishment. Think of Raskolnikov. He is no Atticus Finch. And it's infinitely more interesting and more realistic, again, if you're trying to penetrate what it feels like to be someone else or to bring someone into the head of someone else. You want the person to be real, and that does not make them able to pick and choose their behavior in such a way that they're, you know, that they're leading us. And what I used to call, when I first wrote this, it was so long ago, we still had AAA strip maps that you would get when you went on a trip that would give you a route. You don't do that anymore. But you can still now look, you know, at your GPS or at your, you know, MapQuest, and, you know, you can see the way to get someplace. That's not what fiction writers do. And so I think that's pretty much what I was referring to, you know, when I said that. I think it's something that has to be resisted, and I think moral questions are raised in your writing all the time, but that doesn't mean you solve them to people's great satisfaction as, you know, sermon giver or moralist. And I wrote actually in that same essay at length about John Gardner's book on moral fiction, in which this very wonderful and complex writer, whose first book of fiction was about Grendel from Beowulf, who's not a lovable character. Well, maybe he's lovable, but only kind of perversely. I mean, he's a monster. But he wrote a book called On Moral Fiction, in which he exhorted us to look at the smiling aspects of life, he called them. And he denounced writers like Updike, because his characters, you know, a book like Couples, there are all these people in bed with people who are not their spouses. And he took offense at people like Donald Barthelme and John Barth, who were writing kind of metafiction in which, in fact, there aren't even realistic characters, and he thought that was immoral in a different way because they were wasting our time if they weren't teaching us how to live. And I found this just, you know, he actually recommended, you know, that every book have a dog in it, you know, that, you know, it just seemed like such a strange, overly hopeful, Sunday morning sermon-esque way to write a book. Mm-hmm. And so I really do not subscribe to that at all. And again, I think that all my books raise moral questions. I tend to think of myself as a serious writer, a meditative writer about things that have some significance. I do write books in which moral questions are put forward in some way, framed, but the idea is not to say, okay, given that question, this is the way you should, you know, you should go, because that just seems to me, that's really a waste of time.
Now, that makes me wonder, what would you consider a successful ending in a novel?
I'll tell you what. I will cite. This is not the ending exactly, but I'll cite one of my own books because there's one scene in it that I love more than almost anything else because it so totally says what I want to say. In my book Civil Wars, which takes place in Mississippi about 15 years after the parade of civil rights has gone by, very, very briefly, two children are left orphaned when their parents are killed in an automobile accident, and they come to live with their aunt and uncle. Who are ex-civil rights heroes, hero and heroine, and they have been raised in a really segregationist family and with a very kind of militaristic father and nothing but contempt for black people. And
the two children,
and the two children who are orphaned. And now they find themselves living in a family with not only with these two ex-civil rights heroes, but with their children who have grown up in a very different... I was very interested in how children get their moral bearings, mm-hmm. racial bearings in that book. And at some point, this surrogate mother, this aunt, takes this little boy, O'Neill, who's aged 8, to visit a friend of hers in the Delta. And this was a woman who was based on a real friend of mine, actually, a godmother of one of my children. A black woman who was the mayor of her little town and was an extraordinary woman. And she welcomes the child and gives him dinner out of a pot of pork and beans and everything. And they put the boy to bed. And he's been noticing what a wonderful, warm woman this is and how smart she is and everything. And he wakes up in the middle of the night and vomits. And he's literally vomiting up the incredible dissonance between what he has learned at the knees of his parents and this. What does he make of this woman who is so clearly not what he was told black people were? And so they go back to Jackson, Mississippi, where they live now, where the little boy lives, and Jessie, the mother, stepmother, surrogate mother, whatever you want to call her, watches him. He's sitting and he's kind of, his leg is, you know, kind of bouncing up and down and his little corduroy pants. And she watches him thinking, just sort of threshing this new information and trying to make it match the fact that he loved his parents. And he's discovering doubleness. He's discovering complexity, which to me is why I write. It's to remind us of how complex things are. That right and wrong are just not words that describe the worlds in which we live. And there are some things that are more wrong than others, certainly, mm-hmm. you know, for example, the way his parents lived and what they taught him. But still, there's a continuum that this child had to make his way through to get to sort of greater light. And she watches him and she thinks that now he can be hers because he's acknowledging that you can have two ideas in your mind at the same time, that you can love your parents, but that they could be wrong about some things, and that he has to let in this new understanding of the world. And for me, that is what I write for, to remind myself and everyone else of how complex issues are, people are, situations are, and... you know, what you do then is you put characters in very difficult situations and you watch what happens. And so I can't even tell you what I think, you know, a good ending is, but it's not necessarily a deeply resolved one because I don't think most things are so deeply resolved for us. There are people who certainly are deeply good, but that's not, you know, you don't necessarily write novels in which you have heroes striding through them, leading the way to the rest of us, you know?
Right.
That's much, much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And I should say, you know, this is really, and I have to tell you this quote because it's my favorite of almost everything that's been said. When I met Barack Obama, I live in Barack Obama, I'm Mr. Obama's neighborhood in Chicago. When I met him, he told me, he endeared himself to me hugely at that moment by telling me that he read my novel, Civil Wars, and of course, he had to say he liked it. I have no idea what he really thought of it, but that's the book in which
he seems
this.
Like an honest
guy. Well, he does, yes. He had to say it, but that's the book in which this little boy appears who has to deal with this. And so, it was definitely the right book of mine for Barack to have read. But I was blown away by the fact that anybody in his situation read novels. You know, that was extraordinary. But what it reminded me of was Julius Lester, who's a black writer who teaches at the University of Massachusetts, once said, "You know, I wish they wouldn't always ask
politicians, what's the last book you read or what are you reading right now? Because they'll always give you some statesman like Dean Acheson or Six Crises or, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. I mean, I think that's incumbent upon them. Probably is, in fact, what most of them are reading. He said, you have to ask them, do you read novels? Do you want to know what it's like to be in someone else's head? Mm. And when I think of George Bush and I think of the last 8 years, I think there is a man with no curiosity about what it would be like to be someone else. Mm-hmm. And then I think about Barack, who enters this scene, well, he's not really entering it for the first time, but enters it as our leader, obviously demonstrating, and you know that if you've read his own really marvelous, marvelous autobiography, his memoir, his first one, I haven't read the second, but The Audacity of Hope, but the first one, Dreams for My Father, is an extraordinarily wonderful memoir as memoir. And he wrote it a long time ago, long before he was going to be running for president. But he's so deeply literary, in fact, that it gives you hope that with that kind of interest and curiosity about other people, it is going to have to inform the way he governs. Mm-hmm. There isn't any possibility of having that kind of curiosity and interest and empathy, really, for other people that will not somehow rub off on your capacity to identify with other people. So if he can walk a mile in somebody else's shoes, I will believe it. Bush never even tried. You can say that's a literary failure, but really it's a human failure.
What writers have influenced you, either personally or through their works?
I think I had a kind of funny coming to fiction. As I said before, I started as a poet, and I think that the writing of poetry had a huge effect on me. And I hadn't read a lot of fiction at that point, so when I was being formed as a fiction writer, I didn't have a lot of models to fall back on. I hadn't read Virginia Woolf, if somebody wants to say, oh, Woolf, or I really hadn't read much of anything. In college, I took, you know, poetry courses. So I think that I was in love with words and the construction of words and the concision, the compression, the tension, a lot of things that come from writing poetry. And I think that had a big effect on me and has made my prose sometimes a little bit more, I'm not quite sure what the word is for it. I like to think the word is intense. I don't know if that's always correct. It's not always correct, but... So that, in some ways, is where I would, you know, I would put my emphasis. The other thing is that I took one fiction course in college. I took the same poetry writing course over and over again, which, of course, changed every time we took it with different people in the class. I took one fiction writing class from a wonderful, very sweet man named George P. Eliot. And he, in fact, in some ways, maybe, I don't know if I want to say responsible for, but was very significant in the formation, I think, maybe of this idea of complexity that I like to think, you know, sort of makes my work go. He once quoted a line of Chekhov, and I love Chekhov, but I hadn't read him when I was starting to write fiction. It was from a letter of Chekhov's, and Chekhov said, and I'm paraphrasing it a little bit, he said something about the fact that when he writes, he thinks, look how you live, my friends. What a pity it is to live like that, or that way. And really what I saw in those lines and what George Eliot wanted us to see in them was that you did not condemn your characters and you did not savage your characters. And I've done it occasionally and regretted it. But I think in many ways that's been my kind of moral guidepost. So it hasn't been a stylistic one, mm-hmm. so much as that I hold that up as a touchstone to say to myself, okay, how can you write about people in such a way that you say, you know, when things go wrong, what a pity, rather than you jackasses, you know, what's the matter with you? Why do you live like this?
My last question for writers is always the same, and that is, what advice might you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Oh, you mean aside from don't lose hope? I would, you know, a couple of things. One of them is if you have to, just stop and read for a while. I mean, that's the simplest, and don't beat yourself over the head with it. But of course, it's so much easier to read than it is to write, because in many ways that's a passive activity, that doesn't really necessarily, you just might want to go on reading forever and never write again.
Right.
But the other thing I think is that these days especially, there are a lot of books out there with wonderful prompts and exercises. I teach a lot through exercises. And I like to shake people out of linear forms into something that's maybe leaps around a lot more. Take a line of a poem or a line from a piece of prose that you like and, you know, sort of just write off it. I mean, I have a million of them. I was just telling a class yesterday, or a group yesterday, that I love to do this poem by Mark Strand that's in the form of questions and answers that he and his father are having, you know, a discussion with each other, and it's a quite wonderful poem. And I say to them, take questions and answers, or just questions, or just answers, or anything of the sort, and construct something out of that. In other words, don't think you have to have a story to tell. You can get at a story indirectly, obliquely, in so many ways. But again, these days, some of that has been simplified for us by the fact that there are just so many books that have ideas. There's a little book called, there's a little thing that's shaped like a block that's called Writer's Block that has a different idea a day. And there's a book, they're just too many even to name, but you know, you just don't have to be without them if you don't want to make up your own exercises, or do an imitation. I mean, that's a wonderful thing to do. Take something you like and write something in that voice. Try to catch that voice. Just, there's so many reasons that you don't have to be silent, to just kind of keep your hand fluid, moving, that there shouldn't be any moment when you can't do something, you know. But if you get to the point where you really feel like you have nothing to say, or you just absolutely won't go, then, as I said, then just read. But you can also read analytically, you know, or you could take a character. There's a wonderful course at the University of Michigan taught by Nicholas Del Banco in which he takes some classics like To the Lighthouse and some Hemingway and, you know, some other things, Ford Madox, Ford, The Good Soldier, and he has the characters from one book show up in another of the books.
Oh.
So, you know, if you take a character from Mrs. Dalloway and you put her in The Sun Also Rises, you know, how would she act? I mean, there's so much playfulness
that you can
indulge, that again, you can keep your fingers limber, which is really what it is that you have to do during those dry spells, and then you will get through it. Mm-hmm. Somehow, because the desire to write will come upon you, and it will take you. You know, I start every morning by reading a little bit by somebody, not because I intend to spend the day reading, but because I want to get out of my head the usual, you know, don't I have a matching sock, or, you know, what do we have for breakfast, or whatever. I need to change the cadence in my head. And so I start by reading something, and within a few pages I begin to feel this, oh, I want to do that, coming upon me. And that's what I think will happen to somebody who's really blocked.
Okay.
Just read if you can't do anything else.
Well, great. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, this has been a great pleasure. Thank you.
That, once again, was a conversation with Rosellen Brown from 2009. It was really fun to talk to her. More information about her work can be found online at rosellenbrown.com. And next week, Write the Book features an interview with local author and businessman Bill Schubart. A little short on time for the Bookworm's calendar, I'm going to skip straight to the Write the Book prompt for the day, which is to write from the perspective of someone you find in a news story. Read to learn what's happening in the world, or in the country, or in your town. Find a story that interests you. Familiarize yourself with all the details, and then write from the perspective of a person in that story. For example, you might represent the perspective of the driver who whisked Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier from the airport to the Caribe Hotel in Port-au-Prince, Haiti last night. Imagine his driver's role in the unfolding events, and then write from his or her perspective. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. this show can be shared with out-of-town friends by streaming it at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. And archived episodes are also always made available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. The podcast for each week's show is usually up by Tuesday. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, which I must admit is updated a little less frequently than the podcast site. But anyway, writethebook.wordpress.com. I try to get on there once in a while and update. A reminder, if you have any comments about the show or news about book-related events in our area, please send me an email, writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is community radio, and what that means is that it's all volunteer and it relies on the support and involvement of our community. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. It's just about time for Cheryl Willoughby's The World of Music, which will be on at 3 o'clock in about 30 seconds here. So listen and enjoy. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.